In today's episode, we are joined by Esme Verity, a fundraising coach and alternative funding expert. Esme founded Considered Capital in 2021 to support purpose-led founders to feel confident in pursuing alternative funding avenues through an eight-week program that runs twice a year. Since launching, the program has been attended by 260 founders from over 32 countries. Today's episode is part of a short series dedicated to discussing failure, because fear of failure can hold us back, yet it's a prerequisite for success. Failure is a natural part of life that each and every one of us will experience to varying degrees. How we process and learn from it will prepare us for future challenges. Welcome, Esme. It's so nice to have you on our podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about your startup journey and also a little bit about funding and failure. We're trying to turn around failure so that people don't think it's such a bad thing and turn it into a more positive thing that's just a part of the journey. So yeah, let's get started and dive into it. So Esme, it'd be great to start by talking about your experiences that have led you to starting your startup.
Yeah, thanks for the question and the invitation to join. How I got to Considered Capital, I would describe as a bit of a, wonky journey, as most of us have slightly confusing paths to get where we've ended up, wearing many different hats, doing various different things. For me, I started off really before university in my gap year. I started a different business, somewhat naive, trying to fund my extravagant gap year travels about, 15 years ago maybe. And it was a sort of e-commerce business, quite standard, but it was working quite well. And I funded my gap year. I funded most of my university studies through it. So I worked and studied, somewhat out of necessity, but also I enjoy wearing multiple hats. But coming out of that, of university, I was curious to know where to go next. Could it be something? I was hearing words like scaling, venture capital, get funding, move fast and break things, and all of this, as lots of us here in the sort of startup food chamber. So I joined a very good graduate scheme for young people who are starting businesses, and I was pushed down the venture path as the most obvious way that I could fund a business. So I went down that path, had a lot of uncomfortable, difficult conversations with funders where I was saying all the wrong things. I didn't really understand my motivations for starting my business and where I wanted to end up. Like, what was my exit strategy? What did I want for my business? How fast did I want to grow? How big did I want to be? What did success look like? I wasn't asking those questions because no one really else was. And I ended up not raising venture, but actually going on a very different path. A very good friend sent me a link to this manifesto, which was entitled Zebras Fix What Unicorns Break. And I thought, yes, that is exactly what I have been looking for. I'm not aspiring to be a billion-dollar company. I'm aspiring to be a zebra. We balance purpose and profit. We are not mythical like a unicorn. We are real. We are trying to be sustainable in how we grow. We're not trying to extract. We're trying to give. And we're trying to be fair to all of our stakeholders, our employees, our people, our community. So I was like, I found my people. I'm where I need to be. I'm going to do some sort of consulting as a marketer to figure out how I build a zebra. And I ended up joining Zebras Unite, which is as they evolved into a co-op. And a lot of that process was thinking about how do you fund a zebra? There's lots of elements that are required to build just a standard business, never mind something that's a bit more wonky shaped. And one of them is, how do you find more aligned funding that does not involve investors that are asking to maximize profits, but are using business as a force for good not just for making a lot of money. What do you do? And that sort of journey led me to Consider Capital as a pandemic project. The pandemic was helpful and it gave us, me at least, a lot of time and an opportunity to think. I was living in London and I'm sure a lot of people were just running around manically, meeting people and going to breakfast and going to dinner events and feeling really active and doing busy work. I'm not saying that's not useful, but it doesn't allow us to think big and think what we actually want to be doing with our lives. How could we best utilize our networks, utilize our experiences and what really motivates us? But trapped in your houses, for me, at least, that gave me a lot of opportunity to sit with my thoughts and a whiteboard. And the beginnings of Consider Capital were born through a friend, actually. We started the Alternative Funding School as a pilot with a friend. And then it turned out to be more successful than perhaps we anticipated, as many other people were also looking for community more than anything else. That validation then encouraged me to turn my sort of service business, which was coaching at that point, into a product-based business that I could scale in a meaningful way.
Amazing. What was it about having a side hustle that appealed to you?
Is it about having a side hustle that appeals to me? I don't know. I think it's just the way that my mind works. I come from a family of entrepreneurs. We all have various businesses doing various different things. And that was the goal, really. My parents were like, well, if you don't start a business, what is the point? It provides independence. It provides choices in life and flexibility. So it was more like, oh, being an employee. That was the alien concept in our family, yeah, as opposed to starting a business, which is not for everybody. I think entrepreneurship should not be for everybody. I think it's for a very specific pool of people. And for some people, you take it full time, which is amazing if that's what you want. But some people can run incredible businesses on the side if that's their choice. If you're running on the side and you want it to be full-time, then that's something else.
Great, thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the failure topic. Mm. Have there been any like epic failures that you've experienced? And if so, what was the impact and how did you overcome it?
I think maybe I already touched on one of the failures, which was starting a business without really understanding why. Not in terms of why of what problem I'm trying to solve, which is the obviously a very crucial one and a very common one that most of us are trying to work through, but like, why are you starting a business? What does success look like for you? I think I wasted a lot of time not addressing those big questions, which I think a lot of us do. We put it to the back of our mind and we go, I've got really pressing things to do, like 20 people have emailed me, I've got like demands. I don't have an opportunity to be like, why are you doing this? And if you ask a lot of people, they'll go, I want a big exit. But what is big to you? What is a meaningful amount of money to make? Or the impact you're trying to have, what is a meaningful impact for you? What does good look like in 10 years' time? Are not questions that many people are asking. And I wasn't asking for a really long time. And I think you waste so much time. You go down the wrong path. And for a lot of us, we can't afford to come back up the path. Like, I wasted a lot of money and time pursuing things that were not right, which obviously are very valuable learnings and feel good now as we've come out the other side. But I wish I had addressed those early on or had other people that were forcing me to ask those questions in that way.
What did you realize your why was when you took some time to think about it?
Yeah, I think your why changes and evolves, and I think it should. For me, business is the way that we can do good in the world, is an instrument for creating good. So therefore, for me, it was, how do I build a business that is for the long term, not the short term? Like, I could make a lot of money short term, but it's not sustainable and it's not creating the impact that I want, which is, let's get money into people's hands so they can build the impactful businesses that we need to see to solve the big problems of today that governments aren't solving, that big corporations aren't solving, that big businesses aren't solving. And charities want to be able to solve, but
they have challenges around their funding. So at the moment, that's the why that motivates me.
Yeah, I think that it's so important to understand what motivates you. It's something that I've recently started thinking about as well. I've met founders that have always asked me, if you have lots of ideas, how do you choose? And being a product manager, my response for that was, think about the impact that you're creating from a product mindset. Think about the needs of the users. Try and see if there's a clear need for any of your ideas. But I'm realizing, to carry on day in, day out, motivation is a huge contributor in being able to see that idea through to execution.
Yeah, absolutely. And
you can help build on that motivation by understanding what that exit might look like for you. And I think that making a lot of money isn't really what motivates most people. Because if it was, you might do other things, because there's a significant chance you'll never really make it, you know, that massive, massive amount of money. But that end story could look much more remarkable, I think. It could be selling your business to your employees. So the people that backed you from the beginning and given their everything can financially benefit as well. So you're distributing that wealth much further than just you and a bunch of investors, or even more like your community, right? The volunteers that helped you at the beginning, could you build it for your volunteers and then they end up owning it and not like benefiting financially, but also owning the thing that they need, and particularly in smaller communities that are underserved, having a product that they own and that can use is massive. And knowing that they're not going to be bought out by, like, what happens to Twitter, right? You don't want that for your business. So if people could own it, it's amazing. But there just aren't enough of these stories out there of what the possibilities are, because I truly believe that's what so many people want if they know how to do it.
Yeah. Going back to failures, I have one more question around failure, and then I've got a more positive one. In terms of you being a founder and running your own business, are there any failures that you experienced throughout the course of your life prior to starting your business that have now helped you succeed as a business person?
I think in entrepreneurship, you face failures every day. It's like less about the exact failure, but more about the approach to failure that you accept. And you go, actually, I am going to fail. And maybe 40 to 50% of the things I try and do are not going to end up being where I'd hope to be. But at least I've done it. I've woken up, I've made the move, I've progressed every day, and I've got data on what's worked and what hasn't worked. To give an example, before I started this business, actually, I forgot I did this, but I started a newsletter really as a way for me to have a reason to gather lots of resources and information. The format has largely stayed the same. My newsletter is still a reason for me to gather resources that I think are interesting, useful, and share them. But at the beginning, that newsletter stayed at about 200 people for 6 months. And I was pivoting every week. I was adapting the format. I was changing. Nothing was really happening. I was like, I can't really tell if it's useful. And then I was like, why don't I speak to people and be like, what is useful? What's not useful? If it's my target group, not just anybody and everything, I'm targeting somebody. But I kept seeing it as a failure because it just wasn't growing. And in the end, I was like, you know what? I stopped spoken to people. I know that sort of 80% of people are opening this every single Sunday and find it valuable. And that is enough. It doesn't need to get to 20,000 like readers in 2 weeks. It's really valuable for us more than that people. And for me, that is the business that I wanted. And even our newsletter has grown, but not massively. I think maybe we have 5,000 people now. But we've kept that approach of, as long as it's valuable for a small number of people, that is useful for us. What I thought was a failure for a really long time of not being able to get this newsletter off the ground was actually like, this is what it takes to build something organically with not much money. But when you do figure it out and you do find something that resonates with even a small number of people, that is much more valuable than having 20,000 people on a newsletter. So they open it like once every 3 months, you know. Mm-hmm. You have like dedicated people who weekly email me being like, this is great.
How do you set yourself up for success?
I think it's really defining what success means for you. Going back to our motivation, it's what, in 10 years' time, what would success look like for you? What do you truly want? You can't have everything. For me, that continues to be independence. I could grow this team, I could be much bigger, but I want the independence to be able to take a month off and to go traveling or to slow down, speed up, as my personality dictates. It's the flexibility to be able to do that and to continue to make sure that you are doing something that has the impact that you want. So making sure that we get money in people's hands, but more than that, making sure that they feel confident to get that money. As long as I feel like I'm still on my path, and I think that's success. I think it's setting up those boundaries and being really focused on those things and checking in, right? And being like, oh, actually, you know what? This is going to change because maybe I'm going to have a child, or maybe I've got some other milestone now that I'm interested in hitting. I might need to reassess what success looks like, but I'm really clear on it. It's like my North Star and everything leads to it.
Yeah. You mentioned making decisions, for example, not growing your team because you value independence. It'd be great to understand a little bit more about how knowing what success looks like for you impacts you on a daily basis. What does your day often look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a cost to that. There's a cost to independence and flexibility. For us, what works right now is having a small group of freelancers and contractors that we work with in various different capacities. So we have somebody that helps with our branding and our marketing. You have somebody that helps on sort of admin and operational side, which helps enable me to focus on getting out of the weeds, which I think is not what I did for a very long time. Just because you can do everything or some of the things does not mean that you should be. As a CEO, what is the best use of your time? Big picture strategy, making sure that there is revenue, making sure that you're constantly moving with new products or new ideas and keeping things alive and not stagnant. And then getting in the right people that can help make that happen and treating them well, treating them fairly and giving them opportunity. Because I think that is also one of the big definitions of success in a business, is if you are able to treat your staff, and we're using a broad definition of staff here, you can give them good opportunities and treat them fairly. And I really admire people who are very good managers. I'm still learning and still figuring out what that looks like, but I think that's one skill that I would love to get better at and improve. And there's a real opportunity for business, I think.
Great. Thank you for answering that. Let's move on to talking about a little bit about funding. That's where a lot of your expertise lies. I think you have a lot of value to give to our audience. It'd be great to hear your experience. Let's just start with talking about some misconceptions that people often have. What are some of the common misconceptions that you find that idea stage, early stage funders have when it comes to raising funds?
Oh, I've got so many. I feel like I spend every week dispelling these myths, which is part of why I started this, because you do it yourself and then you're like, God, could I shortcut that even a little bit for somebody else? One of the biggest ones is that there's a high chance you probably don't need to or should not be fundraising. I see that as a sign of success. People come through our programs and go, actually, I'm not going to fundraise. Mm. I'm going to focus on...
Just to dive a little deeper into that, we actually ran a survey when we started She Founds because we wanted to understand how we could help female founders. Mm. Our aim is to try and close the gender gap in the startup ecosystem. Mm. So we asked women, what are the main challenges that you face when starting your business? And 26% of them responded that funding was a major challenge in them starting their business. So it'd be great to understand from you, diving into that answer that you just gave, why would a business not need to raise funds? And why do they think they need to?
I mean, it's not a clear cut answer, but there's a few things to consider. Most businesses don't fundraise because there isn't the funding that really suits their needs. There is a cost to all forms of fundraising. And that cost all the time is your own time. If you're going to raise from angels and you don't have family and friends or a significant network of high net worth individuals, it's going to take you 6, 9, 12 months. If you come from an underserved group, if you're female, if you're in that group, it may take you longer because there are some very real barriers and problems that need to be solved in the venture angel funding space. If you don't need to go down that path, i.e. you don't need money to build your product and to then start selling it, then equity funding, for example, you probably should not be doing it. Maybe grant funding, but the quicker you can get to the point where you can hit revenue and profitability, the better you are. Now, of course, that doesn't suit all businesses. You've got heavy R&D businesses, more product-based businesses. You need a large injection of cash, or businesses that require a huge tech build, AI, all of that, that might need significant more chunks and potentially rounds of that funding. For most businesses, there are ways around it, or there are ways to access slightly different funding. If you still feel like you need to access that funding to get your business off the ground, to be able to hit revenue, to be able to grow, you got to pay staff costs. You need money to experiment, right? Pivot and to make mistakes. Then you start considering what funding suits your stage, suits what you are building, suits the impact you're looking to generate, suits your willingness to give up ownership and control. Because the more money that you raise, the more ownership and control you will lose. And it could come to a point where you're very far away from where you started. And the final one is your exit strategy. All those pieces need to come together for you to decide if funding is right for you. And it's a journey, right? And it costs money often to fundraise, which I know is a difficult pill to swallow. And it is incredibly unfair. And there's all sorts of challenges around access to funding, which, of course, are very real. But you have to really need that funding for a specific reason. And often, some people don't. But they just go, okay, I can get some funding.
It's interesting because it almost seems, well, seems like it's a step in the journey that people have put in. They kind of just, even when they've got their idea, like, I have an idea, I need funding. Like, I want to work on this idea, I need funding.
Exactly, which I don't know how we've got there, but it's not the true reality. And there's very little funding available for that early stage because you are so risky. You're at the riskiest point in your business. And that is why sort of equity funding comes in at that point from angels or from VCs, because they are better prepared and ready to take on that risk. But the cost is, because they're taking on such significant risk, venture capitalists and some angels, individuals that have different motivations, are asking for a big chunk of your pie in your business, and they're asking for high financial return in a short amount of time because of that risk. And so what you find is that a lot of businesses that started off over here that maybe didn't involve tech, weren't massively scalable, but useful, impactful businesses in small communities that need to happen, are shifting their models to more and more tech or tech-enabled businesses, solving, you know, sometimes stranger and stranger solutions, just so they can fit into this box, raise a lot of money, and then go on this like growth all cost journey. Venture capital is a necessary tool, for some businesses, but it really is 1% of businesses are aspiring unicorns, and everybody else is probably a zebra or something similar and needs to really consider what that funding route should be and explore alternatives, or even explore, you know, not funding at all or getting in corporate sponsorship, for example, or thinking through revenue generating opportunities.
The other myths that you think are worth sharing?
Let me think. There's lots. I think another one is that people have this sort of black and white view. You're either a charity or you're a for-profit business that is just there for commercial gain. And there's nothing in between. If you are for purpose and for profit, people get very confused. They want to put you in a box. They want to put you in a charity. And when you go, I'm not a charity, I'm for profit, I'm making money, I've got safeguards in place, I'm creating the impact, look at what I've done. A lot of people get very confused. But actually, this is the future. More and more businesses fit into this balancing profit and purpose. And we need more investors to open their eyes and go, these businesses deserve funding. It's just not going to be maximizing profit. It's going to be, we're creating scalable or even meaningful impact that we need to see, and we can make fair and decent financial return on top of that. We don't need to be maximizing that to the end.
Yeah, interesting, because that kind of really requires investors to change their values, or like their job is to generate wealth, then they'll be wanting to maximize, and that's what looking for other companies that are going to help them or align with that done, down to having more like diverse investors.
Exactly. I also work with a lot of funders and foundations around how they can better support their entrepreneur in terms of this sort of training around how can you be for purpose and for profit, but also how can they take their money and put it in different financing instruments that have different expectations on that financial return. Because a lot of impact investors want it. They just don't know how to do it, and they don't know what instruments exist, and they don't necessarily have the case studies to be able to prove it. And if you are a sort of a fund manager, perhaps even a first-time fund manager, you're taking other people's money, LPs, and investing it, it can be very difficult to go, okay, I'm going to be a first-time manager, I'm going to take other people's money, and I'm going to experiment on a different kind of fund. That's why we have so many venture funds now, because it's a model that's proven to work and that people can get significant financial returns, so that there are a lot of failures. But increasingly, you're seeing more and more of these different funds and more examples of what success looks like. So there is more coming down the line. This is the direction that it's going in. We just see more people in the ecosystem fighting for it.
On to another question. So I wanted to understand a little bit more about the traditional types of funding versus alternative routes. Tell us a little bit more about the two.
Yeah, it's perhaps helpful to provide some definitions here and what we mean by traditional financing versus alternative. So from my point of view, and this is not everyone's definition, it's because it's fairly new space. Traditional financing, I would consider to be, for sort of startups and small businesses, is more venture capital or sort of bank loans, things that exist, that function, but actually don't work for most of us. They work for a very small number of people. Equity financing is very expensive, particularly now. Valuations are higher than ever. Investors are demanding more than ever, and they're taking large chunks of the pie. Things like traditional debt don't work for most of us. We can't access it. We don't have assets. Alternative funding is taking a more holistic view, taking a wide look at the full funding landscape. In a dream scenario, it's just funding. It's not alternative funding, it's just funding. But there is a job to be done in helping people understand what funding options exist and what choices they can make based on what their motivations are and what suits them, versus most people just go out and try and book meetings with like 10 VCs and feel demoralized. But perhaps their journey ends there.
Define as sort of options that people could be looking at.
I find it helpful to provide like case studies here versus just a string of different instruments, because sometimes it's instruments that exist that you can access. But often if you're really wonky shaped, it's about taking some instruments and setting your own terms, bringing these to funders because you know what you want and you know what you need for your business. So an example could look like, it's a social enterprise in the UK called Library of Things. It is a wonderful organization. They help people to borrow DIY equipment. Their mission is twofold. They want to prevent waste, so people borrow and not buy. So it's around helping the climate. And the second one is to be able to serve low-income people that can't afford to buy, which means they end up in a challenging position because they're helping people who are low-income, which makes it potentially difficult to access high-growth funding that's trying to maximize financial return because their customers don't have the money to really pay for this product, and it's not their mission. And so what they've done various incredible things to safeguard their mission. They are a steward-owned, they use a steward-owned model in their business. And what that means for them is that they wanted to protect their purpose and their mission as they brought in external stakeholders. Sometimes when you bring in external stakeholders, they come with opinions, they come with voting rights, and their motivations aren't always the same as yours. And they wanted to separate economic rights from voting rights. Just because you've provided money doesn't mean that you know best in this business. So what they said instead, that they empowered stewards in their business to have voting rights over certain areas. So to safeguard their mission and to make sure that was continued beyond potentially the founders or as they continue to grow. So that's one thing they did, which wraps up in how to build a good business, that is putting purpose above profit. It's to think about who owns it, think about who benefits from it, and how do you safeguard that mission. The second piece was, how do they finance that business when it's a little bit difficult from traditional investors who might not be comfortable with that sort of mission lock. What they did was that they brought on a bunch of incredible angels and individuals from the crowd. So community members could own a part of the Library of Things and could benefit from them. And they, in that conversation, they said to their investors, we are putting purpose above everything. We are going to provide a financial return because we are a very commercially successful business. We've already driving revenue. We have incredible impact. We have incredible numbers. But we're going to provide a fair return to our investors. We're not going to provide VC-type returns. And they opened up the question around what that exit could look like as well. It might not be a sort of a third-party acquisition. It might be, but they set expectations with their angels of, this is purpose, and the financial return will come, but our goal is to make sure that we are fulfilling our purpose. And it's a really excellent example around how you can use business as a force for good and still can make money. The founders will benefit from it. The stakeholders will benefit from it. But that distribution of wealth might look very different. Other models, sort of Patagonia, for example, is a very interesting example. They're taking a steward-owned model. They didn't raise financing, but they declared, what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, that all of their profits from their business would go towards this foundation or non-profit, which is about tackling climate change. So they went, who do you want to benefit? We are a for-profit business. We're making a lot of money. We could just carry on making equipment, but what are we doing all this money? Should one family have all this money? Maybe not. let's redistribute it in a meaningful way. And there's so many examples of this, that the structure looks different, the financing looks different, but it's thinking about what your ultimate purpose is with your business and not losing that, which is unfortunately what a lot of people do as they struggle to get that financing in the first place.
It's interesting because I think as a founder, your company changing its purpose, it doesn't align with you individually anymore, must be like heartbreaking and exhausting.
Exactly. I speak to a lot of successful founders that are seen from the outside as successful, had these sort of exits, sold their businesses, but no one knows the reality of, in lots of those cases, they haven't really made that big amount of money. And actually, they've lost control of their business. Someone else owns it and has gutted it from the inside. They've taken away the staff, they've taken away certain elements. And it's very disheartening. That's not what you went out to achieve. And that's why you're going to be so careful every step of the way, because you can very easily, 5 years down the line, end up running a business that looks nothing like what you intended and is not creating the purpose that you want. So you just drift. It's called mission drift.
Are there any emerging trends or new developments in this area that founders should be aware of?
There's lots. It's a very exciting time. I have been in this space really for maybe, 7-8 years. And particularly in the last 2 years, so much more interest in impact investing, in innovative funding, in social finance, whatever words we're using to describe money that is creating impact, right? And it's a very exciting time because we have so many more funds coming out, and importantly, so many more service providers that can help founders do this. So perhaps you manage to raise fair funding, but then how do you get a lawyer that can design an ownership structure to enable you to take that funding and still give ownership to your employees, for example? How do you do all these pieces? There's so many more people that get it, which is massively exciting because we need more. In terms of specifically funding, I think that's a very interesting opportunity in terms of the generational wealth. So in the next couple of years, there's going to be the biggest shift in who has money that we've ever seen. So baby boomers that made a lot of money are now passing on that money to millennials and younger people who largely are much more socially minded. A lot of this money is held in family offices. So they're doing stuff with this money. And there was an interesting report by UBS the other day around this transfer of wealth, the biggest transfer of wealth in history. And that creates a lot of opportunity, because these millennials don't just want to provide philanthropic money to charity. They want to provide funding for this for-profit, for-purpose world. They're looking for places to invest, and they're looking for what instruments they can use. And that's very exciting and interesting, and something that we could all be capitalizing on in accessing those people.
Yeah. Now, if people want to know more, where can they go?
In terms of finding sort of family offices who are transferring wealth, yeah, that one's the tricky one. It's a big opportunity, but finding them is the tricky one. Family offices are notoriously private because, unlike venture capitalists, they don't need to be loud. And venture capitalists want you to find them and provide deals. Family offices might do various different things in different asset classes. It can sometimes be individuals within the family office that have this particular focus on social good. So like any kind of funding, unfortunately, it is building those relationships. And even if you think that within your network, you can't access money, I do think that there's more opportunities than you realize. To give you an example, I had somebody in my last cohort who was raising maybe $500,000 from me, from individuals in a fund, an impact fund. She was like, I don't know anybody, but I'm gonna reach out to anybody that I've ever spoken to in my life. And I'm gonna ask for introductions, ask for connections, call all those favors that you are owed at this point. I'm sure lots of people have done help people. And now it's like, call in those favors and don't be embarrassed and just ask. And she ended up getting money from those surprising people who nobody would find that they were investing, but they're investing privately for various different reasons. They want to have fun. They want to help female founders. You've got funds that were three people down the line, got a connection, but it's going for it, right? It's not going to happen unless you ask and you're prepared for a million no's, but it's absolutely possible.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story of like how she thought she didn't know anyone and then just being brave enough to contact everyone. I think we were talking about before we started this call about feeling embarrassed, that fear of failing. Everyone's going to be like, well, this is a ludicrous ask. But it's not. I think people are really interested in helping you. So if you met somebody, I don't know, 15 years ago, when you first started working, people are interested in what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. People are lurking. People are lurking on LinkedIn and they're lurking in other places. I always think if you got an email from somebody that you maybe had interaction with or met a couple of years ago, and they had a very clear ask. That's important. It can't be a wishy-washy email. A clear ask. Do you know anybody that is investing in this types of businesses or is interested in supporting female founders or works at this particular fund? I think most people would, if they can, sort of try and make the introduction or try and provide resources. Because it makes you feel good, ultimately. And if you think that you would do it, then the chances are someone else will too. Often our barriers, there are real barriers, but it can also be us. We're a barrier to ourselves. And really just like going for it and getting it just an inch of that confidence. And being like, you know what, if I fail, what is going to happen? If I reach out to 10 people and no one replies, I might feel a bit sad, but they don't know that no one else replied, you know? So it's like, I didn't even know about it. And it maybe it's an hour out of your day. And the return on that investment could be huge versus spending 10 hours going through a database of angel investors that probably get like cold emails every single day because they've ended up on a list. And actually, they don't even invest in your sector, or they haven't made an investment for 5 years, or they made one investment 10 years ago and they're a woman, so they're on this list. So it's about being a bit smart and just going for it.
I'm curious to know whether that's a pattern that you've seen with people that potentially don't come from a background where they're surrounded by people that do this fundraising, or if they're not from that atmosphere, do you find that it's a common pattern that people feel awkward about it?
Yeah. Massively. 80% of the people that do our programs are women or identify as women. I hate to make mass generalizations across all women, but there are certainly themes that do come up in the women that we work with versus some of the men. Mm. And a lot of that is around confidence and being able to ask for the things that we want. Being able to charge money for our services, believing that money isn't bad. We do this exercise in our alternative funding school around our limiting beliefs around money, which is super interesting. And often it's, I think money is bad. I think money is dirty. I think money will corrupt me if I get it. Where does money come from? I don't want dirty money. Fundamentally, we don't think we deserve this money. And if you don't think that you deserve money and should get investment, who is going to give you that money?
It's so interesting, isn't it? I think this often comes through with how we're raised as children, needing to be nice, not being greedy and sharing and all these kind of things that we teach that we've kind of imbibed by to be a good person. It just makes it more challenging.
Particularly women. I think just not wanting to speak about anyone else's experiences, but just in my experience, I was told on a almost daily basis, oh, you're quite bossy, oh, you're quite loud, oh, don't be so aggressive. That's not language that most people would use with boys. They're like, oh, you're opinionated, are you confident, are you doing what you want? And if we have that in the back of our mind, like, oh, maybe we should be less aggressive. Let's just make sure people like us. Because if they like us, maybe they'll just do us a favor. No. They're going to do it because you've made very clear demands and you've made it so that they can't say no.
I think people really appreciate that as well. People want to help you, but they need to know what you need. In the working atmosphere, I also experienced the same issues. The women that you've worked with, how have they come out through the journey that you go on with them?
Yeah, I can certainly see just themes and patterns. I think in terms of what we've seen by people go through our programs, we're actually going to run our next cohort in September. It's just going to be for women. I made the decision this week because I think there is such a difference in how women approach fundraising. And when people come out of our school, lots of women go, oh, you know what? I actually can do this. And I didn't think I could before, but actually I do have the tools. And I should feel more confident about this. And I need to make those asks and demands. And our school enables you to have those tools so you know how fundraising works. And that is part of confidence, particularly with women, is actually just understanding how it works so that we don't feel silly. And there is a limit, but at some point you've got to make the leap. But equipping yourself with information and tools around how fundraising works is massive, because then you can feel empowered to make decisions about it. But it's more than that. If you're surrounded by other people who are in the same position as you, and we design our live sessions very much as discussions and getting to know each other, you realize that most people are in the same boat. Most people are really struggling with building their businesses, and funding is one part of it, but it's bigger. We're struggling with managing childcare. We're struggling with all the other demands that women have, and we're trying to balance it. And largely, I found that more women are looking for alternative funding. And they're looking to create more social good in what they are doing. And we need more funders to realize that women are good at this and they shouldn't be given an opportunity. They just should just be given the funding because they deserve it and that it's a good business proposition.
Before we move into our lightning round, is there anything else that you think is worth sharing with our audience around funding or failure?
I think it's an interesting one around funding and failure, because you face so much failure when you raise funding. So much failure. And that's everybody. There's no one that just goes smoothly unless you're just rich to start with. And even if you're rich to start with, it's still going to be a struggle. So it's about accepting that failure and using the data you get from the failure to learn and make bigger moves. So, for example, every meeting you have with an investor, they're going to provide feedback, thoughts, questions. You might go, oh, you know what, I missed the opportunity there because they're my ideal funder. And you go, why are they your ideal funder? Is the feedback they are offering useful for you? If it is, you go, how can I adapt and change to make sure the next time I've got really good answers to these questions? Because you might come back to them a few months later and in a different position. But unless we're learning all the time, it's just failure.
Great. Thank you for that. Okay, so now moving on to our concluding lightning round. I have some hopefully fun and interesting questions to ask you. It would be great if you could tell us about a hero that's impacted your journey and why. If you could tell us about one thing that they've taught you and you've applied in your startup journey or life.
Interesting question. How can you just have one? I would say, maybe it's slightly embarrassing, I would say my dad. Because I think my dad gave me a real gift in redefining what success looks like. Not trying to follow everybody else, not trying to hit traditional milestones, not trying to have a big paying job in a large corporate, but actually you have one life, and life is about joy. Life is about experiences and making the most of it. And as long as you have independence, i.e. your own wealth, your own source of wealth, then you can create the life that you want. Which I think is quite rare for a parent to instill that, particularly into women as well. To be like, you know, you can have just as much. There's no limitations on what you can do versus men.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize there were limitations until I met, until I was quite a bit older. And I was like, oh, this is what society's been telling me.
Oh. Yeah. It's fine at school, and then you get out of school and college and you realize, like, what's going on?
Like, I went to an all-girls school, so it was even more like, yeah. We're in a little bubble. Yeah.
Moving on to the next question, it'd be great if you could share one resource that you found really helpful that our audience should go and look at. So maybe a podcast or a book or a blog that you've read.
I think it has to be the Zebra Tune Like Manifesto, Zebras Fix What Unicorns Break. It's a fantastic title. When was it written? I'm not sure, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. When I first started selling to people, they'd never read it. It's always the same response. You read it and you go, that is what I've been trying to articulate and haven't been able to. It's everything that I've been trying to put my finger on. But now, and I said it to people, they've already read it, which I love. It's a real testament to the power of branding. Unicorns, it's amazing branding VCs have done to make that seem really appealing, right? And it's, zebras have done the same. They've branded an idea and made it spread, and more zebras exist. And then I send them this article, and they're like, okay, what else you got?
Great. I'm looking forward to reading it. I'll definitely link it in the notes for everyone so that they can go and find it. Is there one quote or affirmation that has helped you on your journey that might help others?
Oh, I'm terrible at remembering quotes. It is part of my dyslexia. Maybe we might have to land on just ideas and thoughts that I've had today that have helped me through the day. Maybe they have come up in this podcast, in this conversation. I think it might sound very simple, but anybody can come up with ideas. You sit down, you've got 20 ideas probably there, but very few people can do them. And that is the difference. Because someone's got an idea and somebody is an entrepreneur, right? And if you need to be a doer, you need to be prepared to sit down every day and take risks and be open to failure and to keep going. And you can't just sit down, imagine, think and plan. It's one of the themes that I see with a lot of the women that I coach, is that we need things to be perfect before we put them out in the world. We need to fully understand how a concept works until we go for it. I think that holds a lot of people back. I'm not saying that we go wild and just like make random decisions, but like, you know enough to make the next move, go for it. Don't try and plan 10 steps ahead.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today. Where can our listeners find you?
Yes, so you can go on our website, www.citicapital.io. We will be the best place to learn a bit more about what we do and access some of our free resources. You can sign up to our newsletter. There's a button on the website. And you can have a look at our blog and some of our videos to get an idea of what is alternative funding. And then if you're interested in taking it to the next step, we have various different courses and masterclasses if you want to start tackling fundraising and seeing if it's a avenue you want to pursue or not.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.